So a couple of things we start out, I want to make sure you're all aware of, both in person and online, of our Wednesday night activities that have restarted. We had such a wonderful Wednesday night this past week with our Midweek Cafe, which people bring food. We open up at 5:30 and we go to 6:30. People bring their own food and we have tea and water and coffee there for folks. And we just had a great first ever gathering of the Midweek Cafe. People brought all different kinds of food, although I think Chick-fil-A was the one by 75% was the main food that people picked up and brought, which was, I guess, really good. I had Chick-fil-A tea, so that was a winner. And then we had wonderful times with our youth and our children and our adults. Our adults are working on a conversation about church DNA. In other words, why are we the way we are? Who are we anyway? And how that works, particularly in this post-pandemic world. And we started talking about the four fragile freedoms of what it means to be Baptist. And honestly, you hear a lot in the news about what Baptists really are, and what we actually are is not what's portrayed in the news. And so we go back into Baptist history and talk about what makes us the way we are. We talked about Bible freedom this past week, and we're going to talk about soul freedom this week. So I'm excited about that and excited about how we can talk about those things and have good conversation and do that in a way that leads us into talking about our church DNA. Because if you haven't noticed, we're not like every other Baptist church around there. I mean, we do things like ordain women, for instance, and lots of Baptist churches do not do that. So we're grateful to be how we are and who we are and how God has called us to be. So you find out more things about us, and if you're new to us, Wednesday is a great time to get to meet people and get to connect and find out more about who we are. So 5:30 for Midweek Cafe, the Adult Spiritual Formation Bible Study time starts at 6:30. And at 6:30, we have time for our children and time for our youth. We had our largest youth group crowd since before the pandemic this past Wednesday night. Had a great crowd with the children. I'm grateful for Leslie Spitzer and Sharon Hertzler, Rick Van Ryan, and others that worked really hard to really create a really engaging space for our children. It's a very exciting time. So if you didn't get to be there this past Wednesday night, I'd love for you to consider being there this coming Wednesday night, because it's a great time to get to know folks and to be together, and it's a great training time and growing time for your own faith. So I hope you'll consider joining up with that. Now, let's start in this conversation. Did anybody ever go to youth camp or some kind of youth church gathering as a teenager? Anybody ever do that? Okay, I did that. Okay, some of you teenagers are raising your hands. That's good. Very good. When I went to youth camp, it was one of my favorite things about youth group. One of the favorite things I did. I loved going to youth camp. A few years when I was in youth group, we went to a camp called Centrifuge, which took place at a couple of different college campuses. And one time I was on a college campus there, a friend of mine and I, we went into the college bookstore. We thought, like, such big stuff. You know, we were big stuff. I was 10th grade watching it into the college bookstore. That's really cool. And I had some money burning a hole in my pocket. You ever remember what that was like? You remember what that was like? And so went in there looking for something to buy, and I didn't really want any of the T-shirts, so I moved to this area of motivational posters. You know what those look like. And so I'm flipping through these things, and I come to one that has this long, winding road that's going all uphill, and it's kind of rainy, and it's this beautiful green hilly scene that is absolutely isolated. There are no houses, there are no stores, there are no anything, and this road goes on for, you're looking at it in the picture, the road goes on for 500 miles. I mean, it's going on forever. At least that's what it looks like. And the only person on this poster is a runner in the foreground at the very beginning of this road going up. And I had not really been done much running in my life. I'd run a few miles here and there, that sort of thing. I didn't know I was going to do that later in my life. But something about the picture struck me. It just struck me that this guy had this whole winding road of uphill in front of him in the rain by himself with no place to stop and rest other than to sit down on the ground on the road. And the caption on this poster said, "The race is not to the swift, but to those who keep on running." And it just clicked with me. It just struck me. Maybe it was because my parents' divorce had been finalized and I was going through all the upheaval of all of that. I was wrestling with my own calling to ministry and what I was going to do with my life. And that poster just resonated with me. I bought it. It went up in my room. And then when I went off to college, it went up on the wall of my dorm. And when I went and moved to my first college apartment, it went to the wall of my college apartment, and then to my next college apartment. And then when I went to seminary, it went onto the wall of my seminary apartment, and then to my next seminary apartment. And then I went to my last seminary apartment, and when I took it down to move it, it had that fatal final rip that let me know it was over. And I mourned that poster, but I remembered what it said. The race is not to the swift, but those who keep on running. By the way, I did look it up on Google, and I did find it online, but the pictures, the images of it on Google are so blurry and so bad that I couldn't show it to you today. But you can look it up based on that sentiment, and you can find it. And it's a beautiful picture with the most 80s-looking runner you could possibly imagine. The race is not always to the swift, but to those who keep on running. It was a few years later before I realized that that was a very liberal paraphrase of a text of the Scriptures. It comes from Ecclesiastes 9:11, where the wise one writes, "I've seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all." Like I said, it's a rather liberal paraphrase of how this works. The point, no success is guaranteed to anyone because of their status, talent, or brilliance. In life, every single one of us faces the reality of time and chance and obstacles. We all face the reality of getting older. We all face the reality of having to overcome obstacles that are in our path. We all have the choice to endure or to quit. This brings us back to our message series, PPP, which stands for pruning, planting, and persevering. This brings us back to the series. It brings us back to Nehemiah. And if you remember from last week, Nehemiah, like us, was going through a rebuilding season. He's been called back to Jerusalem to call the people of Jerusalem into rebuilding the wall of their city because it's been torn down for decades upon decades. And folks had started trying to rebuild it a few different times, but then they'd always stopped and started. And Nehemiah is sent back and called back to be the governor so that this wall can get rebuilt. And he makes his pitch and shares what God has done for him to the people, and the people say, "This is God at work, even in the midst of our rebuilding, even in the midst of our pruning. This is God at work. We want to join and do this work that God has called us to do." So they get busy working. They decide, "We will get started building the wall." And this, friends, is where the real trouble begins. Isn't that how it works? You finally make the decision to do something that you've been needing to do for a long time, and immediately something happens that gets in the way after you've finally gotten started. It just seems like it happens that way a lot of times in life. Nehemiah chapter 4, we're going to start with verses 1 through 5. I want you to hear about this real trouble that starts out. "When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of associates in the army of Samaria, he said, 'What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring these stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?' Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, 'What are they building? If even a fox climbed up on it, he would break down their wall of stones. Hear us, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders. So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. We'll save the rest of that for a minute, because I want you to notice the very first obstacle that the people of Jerusalem face as they begin rebuilding the wall. The very first obstacle they face is negativity. Do you remember Sanballat from last week? We talked about him. He was a leader from an adjacent territory, and as soon as the wall rebuilding project starts, he immediately begins to heap ridicule on the people. Then Tobiah, a leader from another adjacent territory, joins with Sanballat, and they begin to critique and ridicule and complain about all the work that the people of Jerusalem are doing. They even make fun of it in very harsh ways. You look back at that, and it's really astounding. You hear this text here. It says, "Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Have you ever felt that way? Something in your life disintegrates into rubble, and you wonder if it can ever be built back. And you want to believe that it can be, but there are outside voices that tell you, you can't get back to where you were. God's not going to heal that. Can that rubble possibly be restored after all of its brokenness? Sanballat and Tobiah, have you ever noticed how some people, when things get difficult, some people bond together to follow God forward, and some people bond together to focus their energy on tearing people and decisions down. Some people, notice how quickly Sanballat had Tobiah to his side. Some people come together because negativity always draws other negative people. Negativity draws people together, and then the next thing you know, you have people talking negative over the top of one another. And the truth is, friends, we all have to decide who we're going to bond with. We have to decide in difficult days, in pruning days, like where churches are in this time frame. We have to decide if we're going to bond with people who make their community about negativity, or are we going to bond with people that make their community about speaking faith, about speaking how we move forward, about speaking hope? We talked about Sanballat and his syndrome last week. In the face of pruning and rebuilding seasons, we need to remember that some people look for opportunities in front of them and they celebrate every step of progress. There are people who, even in difficult days, are always looking for the next opportunity, are always looking around the corner and wondering what God is going to do. There are people who always say that we are going to look and see where God is going to move next. And then there are people like Sanballat who notice that everything is not as good as it used to be, or everything is not the way that they think it should be, and they complain about it. Then they seek to blame someone else for it. The Sanballats of the world love to point out problems and love to blame others for the way things are going. Why are they so negative? Sanballat and Tobiah did not want the status quo to continue. Well, correction, they wanted the status quo to continue. They did not want Jerusalem to grow and to be a thriving city again, because it would impact their power and impact their financial resources. So they unloaded negativity on the people of Jerusalem in an attempt to keep things the way they were. Often this is the way things happen in churches too. They happen in our personal lives, our companies, our schools. They happen everywhere. When people don't want to change, they often choose complaint and negativity and blame to actual participation in renewal and rebuilding. And because In churches, these are church people, they will put their complaint in spiritual language so it sounds appropriate. There's an aphorism that describes this negativity in urban day slang. I used it with the 8:30 service folks. Most of them looked at me like they didn't know it. The aphorism is this: haters gonna hate, right? You know what a hater is, right? Yeah, a hater is one who hates on everything, complains about everything. This is a story I've told before, and I'm not a hunter, so you're going to have to forgive me so I don't tell it exactly how it would happen. But this is a story I've told before. It's one of my favorites. It's a story about two guys who hunt all the time together. They love hunting together. But one guy, he gets annoyed at his friend he hunts with all the time because his friend is always griping about everything. He's always negative. When it's raining, he wishes it was sunny. When it was sunny, he wished the rain would come to take a little bit of the heat off. When he was up early, he wished he could be up later. When he was up late, he complained that they didn't get up early enough to get the good hunting in. When he had chicken to eat, he wanted pizza. When he had pizza, he wanted Indian food. When he had Indian food, he wanted Chick-fil-A. He never was happy. Griped all the time. So one day, they were going dove hunting, and this the man said, "I'll show my friend," because he had a very special hunting dog, had a very special talent. So they went out hunting together that day, and they shot some doves, and one of them fell in the water. So the man, his friend was like, "Ah, there you go. I finally hit a dove, and it falls in the water." And his friend says, wait a second, I got this. He whistles for his dog. He sends his dog out across the water to retrieve the dove. The dog runs right toward the water and doesn't stop, runs out on the water, doesn't sink, just runs out on the water, reaches down, gets the dove, turns around, runs out on the water, comes back and drops it at the man's feet. So the man looks at his negative friend and says, "What do you think of that?" His friend said, "Your dog can't swim, can he?" Some people, oh, come on, y'all, that was funny. Come on. Yeah, hate is going to hate. That's right, yeah. You know, some people complain about anything. Some people be unhappy about anything. And what we need to understand is that there are people, even in the midst of doing God's mission, even in the midst of trying to rebuild, even trying to take pruning and grow new fruit out of the pruned spaces, there are people who have the spiritual gift to spread discouragement and malcontent. If we try and do what Jesus is telling us to do, if we try to continue to grow and rebuild out of this pruning season, like all churches are having to do during the season, everybody's smaller. The pandemic has done this to everybody. So if we're trying to grow out of this pruning season, we need to expect that there's going to be negativity. We need to expect that some people are just going to hate, because that's what haters do. Everybody knows that this pandemic has created a storm for churches. It's also created a storm for marching bands and restaurants and schools and all other across our culture. Marching band in my kid's school is half the size it was before the pandemic. And I was out there at a game yesterday, and they sounded awesome. And you know what I heard 10 or 15 times as people walked by? "Man, they sure are smaller than they used to be." What the heck, people? Come on. It's the pandemic. Everybody is. We either gripe about what used to be, or we get going on with what will be. And we celebrate what God is doing in the midst of it. Yes, we're in the midst of a storm, but as we said last week, we need ark builders in the storm. We don't need storm chasers. Some people just love to talk about the storm. We need people who are going to build arks that are going to take us out of the storm. Negativity, however, is not the only obstacle that Nehemiah and we face in this season. Read with me Nehemiah 4, 10 through 12. Meanwhile, don't you love it in a story when somebody says, "Meanwhile"? It's kind of fun, right? "Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, 'The strength of the workers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall.' And our enemies said, 'Before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them and will kill them and put an end to the work.'" That seems a little drastic, but okay. will kill them and put an end to the work. Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us. Nehemiah has to deal with the negativity that the people are hearing, but he also has to face the fact that the people are exhausted. They are exhausted from doing this work. Now, the project started strong. People were singing "Just Whistle While You Work" as they took the rubble from one side to another and as they tried to stack it and build it again into the rubble. But then the sun grew hotter. The days grew longer. They kept hearing the ridicule shouted to him, to them by the neighbors. They kept hearing rumors that people were going to infiltrate them and kill them in the middle of the work. They were tired, discouraged. They had not quite seen the results that they wanted. They were emotionally, mentally, and physically fatigued. And then they were afraid that by being out and doing this work, they might actually lose their lives. They might actually get exposed to something that could hurt them. I know this is tough to imagine. But these people were in a season where they were trying to do the right thing, and they were exhausted and fearful that they might be putting themselves and their families at risk. Stop me if you've heard this one before. Exhaustion is rampant in our culture. It grows in all of us as we hear the crescendo of divisive rhetoric and face the daily division around masks and vaccines and seemingly everything else. Nurses, doctors, and hospital staffers are exhausted, particularly in areas where the ICUs are filled to the breaking point with COVID patients, most of whom are unvaccinated, and then also some breakthrough cases that are ending up in our ICUs. Restaurant workers are exhausted. I saw on Facebook a restaurant that I frequent. The owner of this restaurant is pleading with people to be patient because she used to have a staff of 11 people and now she has a staff of 3, which means she's cooking, washing dishes, welcoming people at the front door, and trying to do all of this and stay open long enough so that she can serve people. And some people are complaining because the menu's limited. Really? Bus drivers are exhausted. Oh, and by the way, we have a big shortage on those too, in case you hadn't heard that. Teachers are exhausted. Pastors and pastoral staffs are exhausted. Parents are exhausted, and grandparents are exhausted, trying to balance work, learning, and the concerns for health of children that can't be vaccinated. Residents of retirement communities and nursing homes are exhausted because one week they can have visitors, the next week they can't have visitors, and the next week they're on lockdown. And the staffs of these places are exhausted as they try and care for their patients and their residents. Churches are exhausted. We are in an exhausted culture. It is so hard to rebuild. It's so hard to dream about the next thing that God has for us when we are already so tired. That's the challenge that's facing Nehemiah. That's the challenge that's facing us. How do we, with less energy, embrace God's great, unrelenting mission and vision for our planet? But we don't only face the obstacles of negativity and exhaustion. Just like Nehemiah and his people, we face the obstacle of fear. The people rebuilding the wall are afraid for their lives. The text we just read, folks from the outside, the Sanballats and Tobias, are saying, "We're going to kill you if you keep working." People on the inside are saying, "Hey, I bet they're in the midst of us right now." And they begin doubting and questioning their neighbors. They begin saying, "Hey, wait a minute, I haven't seen you working next to me before. Wait a minute." And they begin mistrusting one another because of this fear that in the midst, they're not even afraid that they won't get the wall finished. They are afraid that something's going to happen to them and their families because of the work that they are doing. And they begin to ask the questions, "Is this worth continuing? I know God called us to this task, but can we keep going? Can God protect us in the midst of this mission He has given us? Wouldn't it be easier to simply quit and preserve our families, preserve our lives? They've quit many times before. What's in their fear is going to keep them from quitting now. And we are afraid as well. We are afraid because the pandemic continues to inject an unwelcome sense of uncertainty into our lives, something that we have never faced. I'm going to scan the room real quick. Yep. Nobody in here, based on my best quick guess, was alive in 1918. Last time we had a nationwide, worldwide pandemic, the flu pandemic of that season. We are less certain in this season about the safety of our families. We're less certain about our financial futures. We're less certain about our nation because of all the division that's going back and forth. Sure, we love our nation, but the division is killing us. We're concerned about our children, our grandchildren. If we're honest, those of you who have made this place your church home, this people, your church home for years and even generations, we're afraid for our church. Because though our finances have been keeping up well, our services have fewer people in them in person. We have a good crowd online, which we're grateful for, that watches during the services and during the week. As I've shared already, we've had some really great experiences already on Wednesday night. But if we're honest, we're afraid. We're afraid for the church where we were baptized, where we were married, where we've seen our children baptized. Children dedicated to the Lord and families dedicated to the Lord. Where we've seen our friends and family members ordained as deacons, ordained to the ministry. Where we buried a spouse or a child or a grandchild or a parent. And then on top of all this, this pandemic is only accelerating what was already happening. The whole change in the world of Christianity to a post-Christendom era, a post-modern era in America, where church attendance has shrunk dramatically, even before the pandemic, where church membership has shrunk dramatically, particularly for Generation Z and our millennial generations. We're afraid of the future. We're afraid of if we can be part of that future, because we all know a church where millennials connect and where Generation Z connect, those churches are going to be very different than large institutions with large physical plants like what we have. They're going to be rooted in community, in smaller groups. They're going to be more decentralized. They're going to be rooted in serving. They're going to ask hard questions and be willing to live with those questions not having answers, except for Jesus. They're going to be real and authentic. And we wonder, how do we be God's good news people in that kind of a new world? Fear leads to paralysis. It leads to hiding. Remember being a kid when things got loud outside in a thunderstorm? Or there was a monster in the closet, you remember that? You'd pull the covers up over your head? Was I the only one that did that? Or cry out for mom or dad? Fear leads to hiding. Fear leads to stagnation and desperation. And fear leads to negativity. And as a matter of fact, most of the negativity that you hear in a church, in a school, in a company, even in your own family, most of the negativity that you hear is not because people are mean, bad people. It's because they're scared, anxious people. Most of our negativity doesn't come from animosity. It comes from anxiety and fear. So what do we do? What do we do? Because Nehemiah's day is not, in terms of the obstacles, much different than what we're facing. We face negativity. We face exhaustion. And we face fear. What are we going to do? Well, let's just say three quick things. We're not going to make it all better in our last 5 to 7 minutes. But let's say three things that we can work with and mull over and pray through in the coming week. First thing we can do is we can eliminate negativity in our lives. We can eliminate negativity in our own thinking and our own words, because we actually do choose what we think about. You and I can actually take the thoughts that are in our head, and we can choose to usher some out of the way and instead put other thoughts in. We can choose what we think about. When people insult us, when people are negative to us or about us, what we can do is we can do what Nehemiah did. What Nehemiah did when Sanballat and Tobiah were hurling ridicule and insults upon them, in verse 5, we see what he did. He prayed those back to God. He said, God, you have heard what they have said about us. You have heard how they have misrepresented and threatened us. You have heard the negativity that has been thrown out. God, please take this from me. And God, vindicate us. Vindicate us. Show that we are innocent and held in your hands. Vindicate us, O God. And take away all of the mulling and all of the thinking I want to do, of all the back talking in our minds that we do with someone that has been negative with us or hurtful to us with their words. Take away all of that, God, and allow me to let my thinking and my heart be focused on encouragement and focused on hope. We choose what we think about. The other thing we may need to do, friends, to eliminate negativity is you and I may have to set some boundaries and stop spending so much time around people that are negative. We may have to say, you know what, this may be a member of my family. We may have to have a conversation with that family member and say, I love you. I want to have dinner with you. I will have conversations with you. But I am not going to sit here and vent about everything that you think is wrong in the world. I can't do it. My emotional health can't take it. You may have to have that conversation with somebody. You may have to, there may be a friendship that you have to have a family meeting with and say, look, I know you're a good friend of mine in our church, but I believe God is calling our church to something powerful and something passionate and calling us to do his mission, even though we have been pruned. And we're not going to be able to sit in the same level of friendship if all you do is sit here and continue to talk negative. Or maybe you need to have that conversation with somebody at work. Maybe you need to have that conversation with someone at your children's school. The truth is, we become what we listen to. We become what we put around us. And if we continually allow negativity to go into our minds and into our hearts, it's going to take up residence and it's going to grow. We get to choose whether we're going to grow love and compassion and hope, or we get to choose whether we're going to grow negativity and fear. Let's choose wisely. You may have to snooze some folks for 30 days on social media. You may have to unfollow some folks because they drive you down a negative rabbit hole every time you see it. You may have to make a pact with yourself that the only thing you're going to post from now on is pictures of your family and pictures of puppies, because you've been too negative with your own posting. Whatever it is, friends, let's fight to eliminate the negativity. Now, I know we've got to hear a critique. I know there are appropriate ways to do that. I'm not talking about pie in the sky, Pollyanna, everything's great. It's not. Everything's hard. We know that. That's a fact. We either choose to keep on running when it's hard, or we choose to sit down on that cold, wet pavement and gripe about how hard it is. One of them moves you forward, one of them leaves you stranded. We have to choose. Second thing we can do is we can rest with God to deal with our exhaustion. Our exhaustion is not just physical. It's emotional, it's mental. We have to find ways to rest with God. I'm reminded about the story we told from David's life just a couple of weeks ago on August 29th. If you haven't watched that sermon, I encourage you to do that. It's August 29th. It's on our webpage. You can look at that. It's on our Facebook page as well. That's the one where David leads his men on a raid. They come back to the town where they were staying, and the town has been sacked, and everything is gone, including their wives and their children. And everybody sits down and weeps until they have no more strength to weep. And when they get done weeping, they decide to find somebody to blame. And they blame the leader, David. As they're getting ready to stone him, which I'm told is a very painful thing, David goes off away from the group. And the text tells us in 1 Samuel 30, verse 6 says, "But David found strength in the Lord his God." In the midst of our exhaustion, we have to find rest that's going to restore the soul. We have to find rest with God. We have to find times to pray where we don't list a litany of things that we need God to answer, but time where we sit with God and say, "God, in the words of Psalm 23, restore my soul." We need rest. We need rest on a spiritual soul level. We need time each day where we rest with God, where we find strength in the Lord our God. This, friends, is the difference between followers of Jesus who quit and simply follow the flow, and followers of Jesus who persevere, focus on God's mission, and see things blossom even after pruning. How will we learn to rest with God? And the final thing I would say to us today is we have to find ways to exchange our fear for faith. We have to find ways to put our fear aside, because, friends, faith takes you forward. Fear leaves you stranded every time. Faith takes you forward. Fear leaves you stranded. The people who were rebuilding the wall, they were afraid. They had faced fear in their past and they'd run away. And now Nehemiah faces his defining leadership moment. They're ready to quit. They're putting down their tools. They were beginning to walk away. And then, because they are scared, Nehemiah, the first thing he does is he takes some action to protect them. Nehemiah 4:13 says, "Therefore I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows." That means they're going to work slower because less people are working. But Nehemiah has heard that they're afraid, and he takes action to protect them, to protect the people. And then he says to the people, "This is fantastic. I return to this often in my life. After I looked things over," Nehemiah says, "I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, 'Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes.'" To the best of our knowledge, they never have a physical fight. There's never a battle that comes out of this. This is a fight where these people have to decide that they are going to fight and overcome with God's power their fear, their exhaustion, and the negativity that is surrounding them. This is an emotional, spiritual fight that manifests itself in a physical way. Nehemiah didn't shrug off the fear of the people. He made plans to protect them, but he did something more. He gave them a renewed vision. He told them, "Just wait and see what will happen when we rebuild this wall. Don't give up now. You're halfway there. Don't give up. We can do this. Remember your God, who is great and awesome, and fight. Friends, don't quit. When everything in you says give up, don't quit. When everything inside of you tells you to go through the day feeling terrified, don't quit. When everything in you that day tells you that you are so exhausted that you can't make one bit of difference, don't quit. When everything in you says, I can't handle one more negative comment, don't quit. Remember your God, who is great and awesome, who will fight on your behalf, who will fight on our behalf, even as we face pruning, even as we face the difficult and remarkable opportunity we have to rebuild. Just don't quit. Remember your God, who is great and awesome, and fight for the spiritual renewal and health of your soul, for your family, for your church, for your community, and for your city. Remember your God, who is great and awesome, and don't quit. I wish I could give you a citation for this story, but I can't. I remember it from when I was a little boy. I was listening to one of my pastor's sermons. Parents, even your little ones who tell you they're bored, they remember things. Because I remember telling my mom I was bored that day. I remember my pastor closing a sermon telling a story. It was a story about this famous piano player who was doing a concert in a concert hall, maybe like Ferguson Center, maybe a Carnegie Hall set up, something of that nature. He was world renowned and going to come and play this black tie concert. And a mother wanted to do something very special for her young son. Her 8-year-old son had just started taking piano lessons, and he was loving it. He was enamored by the piano, wanted to play one every time he saw it. So they went to this concert. Before the concert started, everyone was milling around, and somehow the boy got away from his mother, and up on the stage was the biggest, most beautiful piano he'd ever seen. A full-length Steinway Grand, polished black, shining. And as an 8-year-old boy, he had only one thing that he had to do. And there, while everyone in their tuxedos and their evening gowns were talking, all of a sudden resounding across the ceiling and crannies of the concert hall, came the remarkable notes of Chopsticks. That wonderful tune that has regaled so many parents and piano teachers over the years. Before long, folks were looking around and saw the little boy up there playing Chopsticks, and immediately the judgmental thoughts begin to come, right? Where is that boy's mother? Can you imagine children these days? They don't even know how to behave. Before long, somebody's saying, it's the schools. It's the parents. It's the teachers. All of these thoughts are happening. All this is flowing while the boy is having the time of his life, not knowing the ruckus he is causing. Meanwhile, behind the stage, the maestro hears, and he looks out, and he sees this young boy, and he sees the smile on his face and how much fun he is having. So the maestro sneaks up behind him and puts his arms around the boy and begins to play. The boy starts and looks around, and he looks a little afraid. The maestro whispers to him, don't quit. Keep playing. And the boy keeps playing Chopsticks, and this piano genius crafts this melody and these harmonies across the keys that swell all with chopsticks wrapped up in between, all the time telling this young boy, don't quit. Don't quit. Keep playing. Just don't quit. And they play for 4 minutes, and they come to the resounding final piece, and they finish with a flourish. And everyone applauds, and a standing ovation is given. And the maestro steps to the side and puts his hand to the boy, and the boy bows. It's amazing what the maestro can do with a life when you just don't quit. Friends, I'm going to ask our maestros, our Transform Praise Team, to come forward and play and sing and lead us in worship. I'm going to be in the back, and Pastor Walter will be on the back on that side. And we're going to be praying for you in person, for you online, because we know, because we're there too. We're exhausted too. And we know how easy it is to quit right now. So we're going to pray over all of you and for ourselves as well, that we will have the encouragement to remember our God who is great and awesome, and just not quit. If you'd like to come to the back and let us pray with you, we'd be more than honored to do so. If you have any questions about our church family, about how to follow Jesus, we'd be more than happy to talk to you about those as well. But friends, as we worship together, let's renew ourselves by the power of God to put down negativity, to not let our exhaustion get the best of us, and not let fear be what drives our decisions. Let's be people who, by the power of God, just don't quit. Would you sing?